Welcome to Kids Considered, where two pediatricians discuss children's health topics of interest to parents in a podcast with new subjects considered every episode. I'm Dr. Lena Vanderlist.
And I'm Dr. Dean Blumberg.
And we're both pediatricians at UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento, California. Today for the podcast, we're joined by two amazing pediatricians that I have the privilege of working with through my role on the board of the American Academy of Pediatrics local chapter here in California. We have Dr. Naomi Barduck. She's a pediatrician at University of California, San Francisco, a climate researcher and a policy advocate working to address climate change. And we have Dr. Sonia Swenson, a pediatrician in San Francisco. Together, these amazing women co-chair our Climate Change and Child Health Committee for the local AAP chapter.
And because of the length and importance of this topic, we're going to divide it up into two episodes. So the first, we'll speak with Dr. Swenson and detail how climate change is impacting pediatric health.
And then in the second part of our discussion, we'll talk with Dr. Barduck and provide practical tips for what individuals can do personally, as well as current advocacy work to help ensure a better future for our planet and our kids.
Let's start at the beginning about climate change and talk about the trends that we're seeing with climate change on a large scale. So Dr. Swenson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I always think climate change is one of those things that a lot of us are kind of like living in blissful ignorance about, unfortunately. But can you tell us a little bit about what the largest contributors are to climate change currently?
So greenhouse gas emissions generated by humans are the main cause of climate change. And when I say greenhouse gases, I mean carbon dioxide, methane that are emitted when we burn fossil fuels. So we burn coal, oil, gas, and we do these for transportation, for electricity, for heating. And these greenhouse gases act like a blanket around the earth, trapping that sun's heat and raising temperatures. In the last few decades, you know, the categories of human activities that most contribute to these greenhouse gases and to climate change are, one, transportation. So that's a big one. Our reliance on cars, buses, airplanes that require fossil fuels is a major contributor to climate change. Electricity and heating that we need for industry and our workplaces and our homes is another big contributor to climate change. And also our food systems. So some of the highest emissions come from industrial farming, raising livestock, especially beef cattle, and also fertilizers, food waste. And so, you know, these are some of the big categories that that I think about. And when we hear these, we can think, oh my gosh, I have to stop doing all these things. But I think an important message that I like to keep in mind, and I encourage others to as well, is doesn't mean we have to take away the transportation or stop driving cars entirely, but we need to change the way that we do each of these things so that we lower our overall carbon footprint and decrease the amount of greenhouse gases that we're putting out into the environment.
I just want to clarify one thing, which is that we know that the climate changes over time. We had the Ice Age, and then we had the Little Ice Age. I can't remember exactly when that was. That was in the 1200 to 1600 or something like that. And you know, those are natural changes over time, but the human activity and the emissions from these human activity, this has been a dramatic change that has really, it's not due to natural, the climate change we're seeing now is not due to these natural phenomena.
Correct. We've seen that since the Industrial Revolution, so since the 1850s, the temperature of the globe has steadily been getting warmer, and each decade of the last 30, 40 years has been hotter than each of the decades before. And this is agreed upon by climate scientists around the world that this is as a result of human activities.
Okay, so we're all pediatricians, so we care about children probably more than we care about adults. We care about adults too. But, you know, tell us why climate change really will impact children's health more than adults. Is it just a matter of time that children have longer to live so they'll experience this more in the future? Or let us know about this.
Yeah, I think this is such an important question. And you're right. It is partly about time that children will have more of their lives that is living in a warmer climate in a world affected by climate change. But I think of really four main reasons that kids are especially vulnerable to climate change. So the first being that kids have less control over their environment and often rely on adults to help them adapt to the environment. So, you know, young kids, toddlers need help removing layers of clothing when they get too hot. They need help getting out of a hot car, getting a drink of water during a heat wave. They need reminders to drink. Kids also cannot vote, and yet the decisions to act or not act about climate change will continue to affect them for the rest of their lives and the lives of future generations to come. So that's the first reason. The second reason are that children interact with their environments differently than adults do. So babies are on the ground all the time. They're crawling, putting things in their mouth. Older children tend to spend more time exercising outside than adults do. They're running around at school, on the playground, at recess, on artificial turf, for sports competitions. This difference in their activity and their interaction with the environment make them more vulnerable to extreme temperatures, heat waves, and poor air quality from wildfire smoke.
So third, children are growing rapidly and they have a higher what we call metabolic rate. So they eat more food, drink more water, and breathe more air for their size than adults do. So a normal breathing rate for a baby might be 30 breaths a minute, whereas the adult sitting next to them might take 15 breaths in 1 minute. And this means that when the air quality is poor, children are getting a higher dose of air pollutants than adults do. And fourth, children's bodies and their brains are developing and therefore uniquely susceptible to any disruption. We have good evidence showing that exposure to extreme heat and overheating in early pregnancy can disrupt what we call neural tube development. That's the part of the embryo that develops into the brain and spinal cord. And another example is that long-term exposure to particle pollution during pregnancy and childhood is linked with reduced lung growth. And so for these kind of four reasons, the limited control over their environments, the greater interaction with the natural world, and their rapid growth and rapid development, children are especially vulnerable to the effects of climate change.
I want to go through today some of the specific consequences of climate change and the impact on kids. So you've already talked about some of them. I think the most I see in my day-to-day work here living in Sacramento is extreme heat waves where, you know, we're in the triple digits for a month, it feels like, and kids aren't going to the playground because they're going to burn themselves on the slides or something like that. But also recently, we've seen like insane flooding here too. And it's like, it's not just one thing. So can you talk about some of these specific consequences that we might run into?
Sure. And I think heat waves are a good example, as are the storms and flooding. I tend to think of these categories as a general pediatrician in three kind of main buckets. So physical health consequences, mental health consequences, and academic consequences. So thinking about extreme heat, you know, we see increased physical health harms when these heat waves come through. So infants being left in an overheated car, teen athletes suffering from heat stroke after practicing outside on a hot day, kids getting dehydrated as their bodies are overtaxed trying to cool off. Some of the mental health impacts, interestingly, on hotter days, we see an increased admissions to the hospital for bipolar disorder and anxiety disorders for adolescents, increased psychosis among adults, and more reaction disorders among younger kids. We also see substance disorders, hospitalizations spike when the ambient temperatures rise. And then finally, we see heat affects also children's ability to learn. So many schools might not have the infrastructure, air conditioning or fans or filters in place to adequately cool and ventilate a classroom. And so as extreme weather events increase, we see more school closures for heat days, which we know are disruptive to children's learning. And even when kids do stay in school, their learning can be disrupted by heat. One study that I saw from 2020 looked at 10 million students taking the PSAT, and there was an association between hotter school days and lower test scores. That was from a group of economists. And, you know, I bring these up to both highlight that severe weather events can have significant consequences for kids' health, but also that, you know, there are things that we can do to change. So the cooling centers that many counties have been able to set up and encourage families to go to, you know, schools taking initiative to update their ventilation and HVAC, you know, heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems to provide those safe places for people to gather in these events. And I think it's really important to remember what we as a community can do to help buffer against these extreme weather events.
So my practice as an infectious disease specialist, in my world in infectious disease, there's a lot of talk about climate change and how that might affect infectious diseases. One area is vectors, so how the climate change might change the distribution of certain mosquito species, for example, and change the risk of getting dengue or Zika virus or other issues, or some of these weather events that result in floods can also pose a infection risk. What are we seeing with this?
We are seeing a change in the infectious diseases that are the spread of where they're happening and how frequently they're happening as a result of climate change. And the reason for this twofold. So first, as human neighborhoods, cities expand, we are have, and also as these extreme weather events force animals to relocate, we are coming into more contact with nature in some ways. So think of this as, you know, with ticks and tick-borne illnesses that human pets, as we go out in hiking, or which is great, or as we build further and further, their human pets come into more interaction with the ticks, and the ticks might come home then with your dog after a hike, and that can spread to the family members. As animals are sort of on the run, as their own food sources are decreased or they have to relocate due to changes in the environment, we're having increased interaction. And then secondly, just that many of these insects, arthropods, like warmer climates. So in particular, the rising nighttime temperatures provide mosquitoes with longer seasons of ideal climate. Warmer temperatures can accelerate mosquito development, increases the rate at which they bite people, and even accelerate the incubation of disease within a mosquito. So all of these reasons sort of explain why we see an increased frequency of mosquito-borne illnesses as well as tick-borne illnesses.
So one thing that we get frequently living in California, I know you guys as well in the Bay Area here, are air pollution issues and wildfires. I read, and it sort of sounds like you mentioned this too, that some of this air pollution can cross the placenta during pregnancy, impact the developing fetus. You mentioned the lung volumes being smaller. And so that sounds like one obviously horrible thing that air pollution can do. But talk about some of the other impacts that we're seeing from air pollution on kids.
You know, you mentioned the effects on the baby in the womb. We have evidence showing that wildfire exposure is linked with higher rates of preterm birth and lower birth weight of infants, which has lasting consequences for the health and development of the child later on. Kids with asthma in particular will often require rescue medications and hospitalization when we have really smoky days. But non-respiratory conditions also flare. So we know that children and adults with atopic dermatitis or eczema, more commonly known, come to clinic more often when there's wildfire-related pollution. And if we think about the longer effects of wildfire smoke over time, we know that being exposed to more air pollution in childhood is associated with those children going on to have asthma or COPD as an adult too. So not just in childhood, but also later in life. In addition, wildfire smoke is associated with cardiovascular disease, certain types of cancer, and even and diabetes later on in life. So it really affects the entire body, not just now, but in the future too. And while we've focused on the physical health effects, there is increasing recognition about some of the mental health effects too of wildfire smoke. So in communities and homes that have been lost to wildfire, certainly, we know that both adults and children are more likely to have anxiety and panic disorders that last for months afterwards. And even people who aren't necessarily their homes lost in the wildfire, people who breathe bad air tend to have higher rates of anxiety and depression. And then thinking again about the academic consequences in schools affecting how kids learn, I think it's really important to recognize that asthma exacerbations are one of the top reasons that kids miss school days. And so as air quality worsens, leading to more asthma exacerbations and more school absences, we see, again, increased disruption in kids' learning. Like heat, wildfire smoke is associated with lower test scores for all kids and not just those with asthma. The good news is that, again, improving ventilation in schools can help to decrease school absences, improve math and language performance, and choosing to invest in the actual infrastructure of the school can help mitigate all of these things at once.
So a lot of us that have experienced wildfires are familiar with something called the AQI, the Air Quality Index. And so for us that have lived through this, I don't know about you guys, but I would be like looking at my phone every day. There's like certain apps that you can check the Air Quality Index to see like if it was in an unsafe zone or how we were looking to determine like if I would, you know, go out for a run or, you know, do any of these things. And so parents would message me on our like electronic health record or at their well child checks and ask like, Dr. Lena, what do you think is an appropriate AQI for my kids to play outside? Or like, which is so sad, but like, what kind of precautions should I take? Should I make them wear a mask? Like, do you have any thoughts on this? So I'm wondering, I was always kind of at a loss. I actually like went to Twitter and like tagged all my climate friends. And I was like, what do you guys think about this? But do you guys have any recommendations when families talk to you about that?
So the Air Quality Index is one of those things that provides a lot of information, and one can get really focused on the numbers when they're increasing or decreasing. But it's also important to keep in mind, okay, what is the big picture? What are the actual actionable items that I'm going to do based on this information, so that it doesn't lead to an anxiety spiral? I encourage families to be familiar with the Environmental Protection Agency site, airnow.gov, for information about air quality. It uses not only the AQI number, but also a more user-friendly color system to help you make decisions about your day. And this helps to keep in mind that the Air Quality Index is both a number, but there's also recommendations based on the person you're considering. So, you know, many people ask, am I a sensitive group? Am I not a sensitive group? Because there's that one band that includes a sensitive group. In broad strokes, an AQI, you know, 0 to 50 is good, and that shows up as green, and that's a good time for anyone to be outside. The AQI of 51 to 100 is moderate and shows up as yellow. And for most people, that's still a good day to be outside. Some children and adults may be a little bit more sensitive. And so some people might already have some symptoms, some cough, itchy eyes at levels in the 51 to 100 range. That's in the yellow. The AQI of 101 to 150 is where we get into that unhealthy for sensitive groups, and it's colored orange. I think it's important to know that sensitive groups includes children, in addition to adults with lung disease and older adults. So really, for all of my patients, the AQI, you know, this is unhealthy for children. And what the EPA recommends is that it's okay to be active outside, especially for short activities like recess or PE. But for any longer activities like athletic practices, it's really important to take breaks and do less intense activities. We should be more watching out for symptoms and take action as needed. And of course, any students with asthma should have their quick relief medicine handy and follow their asthma action plans. And so, you know, what I tell families is that once you're getting into the orange zone, it's important to start thinking about making some modifications to your day a little bit. When the AQI gets higher, so 151 to 200, then we expect general populations to have more symptoms, and children with asthma may have more serious health effects. And this is when the EPA recommends that everybody take more breaks, do less activities, consider moving longer or more intense activities, or just rescheduling them to another day. And so if you only have to remember one number or one zone, it's really that above 100 and kind of in the orange zone, I think, to start making modifications.
I was just going to say, I think the local news has been paying attention to that over the past few years. When the AQI is concerning, they publicize that and let people know that you shouldn't be outside, you shouldn't be doing vigorous activity, you know, to pay attention to your local AQI.
Exactly. And I think that the more that we can take this decision and this mental juggling of all these factors out of the minds of parents and who are already juggling so much, and instead turning to our public health resources, the local news or the local public health system to help us give guidance on what to do in those situations, rather than having to have all the burden on themselves to make each decision every day, is easier for everyone.
Yeah, definitely. And we will link that website on our blog so that all the parents have access to it as well. We've talked about air quality and wildfires. We've talked a little bit about infectious disease risks with climate change. How does climate change impact our access to nutritious food? So I think as a Californian, you know, driving from Northern California to Southern California, I see these, you're laughing, right?
I know exactly what you're going to say.
You see these like empty fields that used to be filled with crops. And of course, they have like their signs that say like Congress created Dust Bowl or other things that are going on. But, you know, part of that is water scarcity, right? And then I'm sure there's a lot of other, you know, things that are beyond our discussion.
Well, and
today.
Then also halfway down to from here to LA on Highway 5.
Oh,
there's
the slaughterhouse.
The slaughterhouse, like the tons of cows. Yeah, and you mentioned earlier about, you know, the beef industry and all. So that really does, you know, tell us how climate change does affect access to nutritious food.
Yeah, so definitely the extreme weather events that we see with climate change pose major risks to farmland. So the droughts, the floods, kill crops, kill livestock, and that has an immediate effect on food availability in some communities and the economic consequences for those communities as well. Wildfires destroy farmlands, grasslands, rangelands. But in addition to kind of those direct effects, there's also a longer term damage that happens to the soil when it comes to extreme weather events. So when you have really dry soil and then a lot of rainfall, that can wash away a lot of the nutrients from the soil and undermines the nutritional value of that food for seasons to come. The other piece of this is that sea level rise threatens the agricultural communities, which are also an important part of California's agriculture. We see as sea level rise, increased erosion, loss of agricultural land, and saltwater intrusion. So this not only limits the space that can be used for crops, but also contaminates the local water supply. And to me, you know, the link between food and the environment highlights just how urgent it is that we address the climate crisis now and not later. And although it can feel sometimes overwhelming, we need to start making these steps forward and remember that everyone is going to benefit when we work on decreasing our collective carbon footprint.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, just like what you said, climate change affects everyone. And it's hard to feel like any of us can escape it. But we do know that there are some racial and socioeconomic disparities that might impact some people and kids more than others. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we certainly see both racial and socioeconomic disparities. And I'll highlight a few examples. One is redlining, which some people may have already heard is the historic practice by which government homeownership programs excluded people of color and especially Black residents from getting access to loans for mortgages. And these historically redlined neighborhoods are still today less likely to have green spaces, less likely to have shady tree canopy that are so important for lowering heat and sun exposure, especially on hot days. So because of these historic practices and lack of investment in historically redlined communities, children of color are more likely compared to their white peers to live in areas with a higher baseline level of air pollution. And this can get worse when wildfire smoke is present or when it's a really hot day. A second example is flooding. So people with fewer socioeconomic resources are more likely to live in lower lying areas and neighborhoods that are at greater risk of flooding risk. And also, once a flood has happened, the financial resources needed to repair a home or recover losses from that event can often send a family that was maybe just making ends meet fall further behind and go into further financial distress. And the third example, which I've alluded to before, is the access to air conditioning and ventilation, that children with lower socioeconomic resources are less likely to have air conditioning or air filters in their home, making them, again, more vulnerable on hot days and on smoky days.
Yeah, that's a big one. I have, you know, some families in my practice that I always think about because the kids are dependent on technology, whether it's like a CPAP at night for them to sleep, or, you know, some of them have tracheostomies, which means that they have to have a special machine that helps them breathe. And sometimes when we're having these extreme weather events, be it, you know, severe storm or severe heat, the electricity gets shut off here in our area, and that's happening more frequently. And so I've really worked with those families specifically to say, like, work with the utility company to say, like, no, this kid cannot have that happen. Or, like, if they can't pay their bill for whatever reason, you know, talking about, you know, disparities, you cannot turn it off on them because this person has a, you know, a condition that requires them to have that on. And so that's the one example I think about when we talk about these kind of events and how it can impact people.
You've discussed the tangible consequences of climate change on our health and also touched on mental health effects. Can you also discuss the fear of what the future looks like for future generations? I mean, this specific form of anxiety that some people call climate eco-anxiety, how can we screen for this in our patients? How can we give them hope that, you know, that there is a future for them?
Yeah, so eco-anxiety and climate anxiety is so real for many children, many families. In one recent international survey of over 10,000 youth in over 10 countries, they found that approximately 3/4 of young people feel like the future is frightening, and over half reported that climate anxiety was affecting their daily lives to some degree. So I expect to see this in especially my adolescents, but even the younger kids as well, especially as they start to notice changes in their routines related to climate changes. And there are a number of different scales out there for capturing climate anxiety. There's a climate anxiety scale, HOG eco-anxiety. I don't actually use any of these in my practice right now. In my primary care, pediatrics, and urgent care practice, I still use a general anxiety screen. However, if a child does screen high on the general anxiety screen, I will ask more specifically about what their concerns are to determine if climate anxiety is a piece of this. One, to label that concern for the child and parent and acknowledge that what they're struggling is something with is something that many other young people are struggling with, and it's not just them. And also connecting them in some way to a group that is working on climate change. Seeing role models and adults in their community work on climate change is one of the most powerful antidotes that we have to climate anxiety. So, you know, get kids involved in something local, something at their school, something in a community, in your community, and have the parents do it too, especially for the younger kids, to show that adults do care about this. It's not just that we're kicking the can down the road and waiting for their generation to solve this. We need to show kids that we are working on this for them and for their future so that they have some hope. And also, I think that community feeling around making a difference in this big, scary, fuzzy topic of climate change that feels so overwhelming can help us all get through it, because really every single one of us, as I mentioned, has been affected, and every single one of us will benefit from the changes that we make now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an amazing way to end this part one of this discussion. I think it's so important. And for our listeners, don't worry, we're going to give you lots of other tangible actions you can take to improve your impact and reduce your contributions to climate change and reduce your climate health risks. So in our next episode, we're going to be talking about just that, as well as some of the larger scale policy priorities to advocate for. Dr. Swenson, thank you again. And I know you'll be circling back with us for a little bit in our next episode.
That wraps up this episode of Kids Considered.
You can find more information on our website, kidsconsidered.ucdavis.edu.
Follow us on Twitter @KidsConsidered.
And Instagram @KidsConsidered.
If you have feedback on this show or topics you would like us to discuss in the future, we would love to hear from you.
Please call us. Our number is 916-915-3388.
Or email us @KidsConsidered@gmail.com.
Please rate us on iTunes or wherever you subscribe to your podcasts.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us for our next podcast.
Kids Considered is sponsored by UC Davis Children's Hospital.